Hi, I'm Corey Rabin, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcasts. And I want to welcome our guest, Faust Ruggiero. Faust is here. And Faust, where are you actually physically located right now?
Corey, I am in Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania, about an hour and a half from either New York or Philly.
We're really grateful for your being on Crosstalk Podcasts. We like to have experts in the field of addiction and recovery, people who have treated, people who have suffered from substance use dependency, alcoholism, drug addiction, and other kind of dependencies. I know you've done things outside the scope of just addiction treatment. Why don't you tell our viewers a little bit about yourself, what kind of practice you have, and how you connect with people and what you do?
Well, thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me on. You know, it's nice to be spending time with you again, for me, it's been four decades of counseling people, everything from individual, family, marriage, drug and alcohol, depression, anxiety, abuse, you name it. It's been a long haul, and I'm still doing it. I'm just turned 70, and I'm still actively counseling a whole lot of people and writing books and doing all these, the kind of things just to get to keep the word out there, keep it fresh. And from my perspective, to keep it green, to keep it to the point where we're focusing on causes of things and we're not watering issues down. You and I were talking about that before, where we're not making things easy for people to, skirt the issues they need to focus on. So, it's been a long time, but I'm still loving it.
And when you treat people who come to you and they're in the early stages of recovery, some of our viewers are people who are trying to get on the right path, who really don't know how to do it. One of the hopes that we have is that some of our listeners are people who are trying to find how to get on that path. Initially, what are the kind of messages that you'll talk about with someone who either has just come out of rehab or is contemplating going into rehab? What are some of the things that you try to bring to their attention?
Yeah. Corey, the first thing, and that's the common sense piece of advice to give everyone starting, is don't think you're going to do this alone, and you got to be willing to follow people. Addiction particularly is one of those things we like to keep secret, whether we're doing it or whether we're the family members of or significant others. We don't want people to think whatever we think they're going to think. So, we try to do it alone. The first thing is to realize if you could have done it alone, you would have. So, be willing to let other people in. Tell your story. Be honest is the next thing. You got to go right to the heart of it. You can't water it down at all. The thing you don't talk about, the thing you don't get honest about is what's going to come back and haunt you later on. It'll be the thing you don't fix. So, those two items, let other people in, be willing to take their advice and do it. And then, be honest about it and willing to work on what you have to work on.
Why do you think people, keep these things a secret? What's the motivation?
If I have the drinker or the person using the drugs, I may still want to keep doing it, So I may want to fool people into believing I want to go into recovery, but I want to keep that little thing back there where I can cash in if I have to. Family members are always worried about public sentiment. What are they going to think if, I always tell the story of the fella comes in and said, and I said, we got to get you to AA. And he says, great. Once I go to AA, everyone's going to know I'm an alcoholic. And I said, yeah. And when you're dancing on the bar with the lampshade on your head, they never would have figured that out. It's what you've done is already there. People see it. You getting help. That's when people look at it and say, good for you. They understand the power in that. They understand the bravery, and the willingness to take this thing by the horns. Being secretive about it, it doesn't do anything except keep the problem going.
So you've been a psychologist for a long time. It occurs to me that when the program, the 12-step program, started almost 100 years ago, the word anonymous was attached because the stigma was enormous. The idea that somebody would be unable to control their own behavior was the type of thing that if someone knew about it, you wouldn't be in business anymore. Nobody would come to you if you were a doctor or a lawyer, even if you were an Indian chief. Today, it's a little bit better. And the reason we're using social media with Crosstalk Podcast is because we think today coming out of the recovery closet is an important thing for people to do. Have you seen that change in your practice, and has it become a source of power for people?
You know, I've watched it. You know, when you do it, the one thing about being older and having done this for so long is you get to, chronicle all these changes. And when I came on, there were two reasons I heard about anonymity. And, one was that stigma. We don't want, you to have to feel like eyes are upon you. And the other thing is common sense. What happens in the room should stay in the room. And we want people to understand that. We have to keep in mind that people that are running meetings, that are chairing meetings, they come from all walks of life, so they may not have a good feel about, keeping things tight and in the room. So, on the one hand, we want to get that stigma out there and say, hey, we do want to come out of the closet, if you will. We do want to be able to say, this is nothing more than a condition I have. That's what it is, and there's nothing to judge. On the other hand, we still want to make sure that what stays, what's expressed by people stays confidential. Because if we don't do that, then people are going to hold back when they go into meetings. That'll just be a reason not to disclose, not to share. So, we walk that line. Hey, be proud of who you are. Be proud of the work you're doing. But in the meantime, let's keep it tight and in the group so we can keep the trust going.
And the same thing, I imagine, is an issue with family members, because the family members, do you think that we've seen a little bit of a change with the way family members have reacted on the issue of anonymity?
Yeah, I do. And family members now are a little bit more willing to tackle this thing and say enough. Before, I think they were afraid that, that what if they did something, it was going to upset the balance. It was going to make the family member use or drink or whatever. And teaching them that they really have no control over that. They didn't make the person use, and nothing they do is going to either help them or stop them or make them use. That's up to them. All they can do is make sure they are healthy, and a healthy family member is much more able to deal with someone who's struggling.
So what do you do when you're in a family unit where you have some people who get that and some people who themselves are either not, maybe they haven't crossed the line into being an alcoholic or being somebody who's would be considered a drug addict, but they dabble, or there are kind of things that go on in the family unit, extended or the nuclear family, that create a difficult environment. What do you say to those family members about how they're impacting the person of concern, the person who's needs rehab or is in rehab? How do you deal with that kind of situation? It's one thing to deal with the people who are saying, we never had a drink, we never did anything. It's another one where they come from a family where the normal thing to do is to be, having drinks every day or dabbling into different things.
The first thing I tell them is that, it doesn't matter what disease is in your family. You have a person suffering from cancer. You change when you deal with that person. It affects you. It has it will enter your life. It will make you think and behave differently. Addiction is very powerful. And I try to get them away from this notion that, hey, I don't have the problem. It's that person's. That's the person using. And there's some truth to that, but that's not the whole picture. We all change when there's an addict in the family. We think differently. We become more protective. We realize we're not being truthful. We're not We're not dealing with our own feelings about it. So, you know, the first thing I say to them is, well, you know, let's look at you. Okay, you're the addict is the addict, but you need to look at what's happening in your life. You need to look at your own, you know, it gives you the opportunity to do some soul searchings. You know, why did you even get involved with that person? How many times, you know this, how many times do family members get involved with addicted people? Because they come from addicted backgrounds. You don't have to drink to have the, some of the components of the addiction. So, you know, when you get to the point that they also surrender, which is part of what I'll help them do, then they start looking at themselves and they realize that regardless of what happens, whether that person gets sober and enters into recovery, or they continue to do what they do, the family members have their lives and they have to be healthy. They have no control over what that other person is going to be doing or is doing. So it's all about their health.
So when you're dealing with somebody who's in the initial stages, trying to get their act together, how involved do you get with the family in terms of, you know, what the whole approach should be? Because when somebody goes to treatment, sometimes it's 28 days, 30 days, sometimes it's longer term, but eventually they're going to come back into a situation where the wife or the husband and the baby are there, or mom and dad are there, or whatever the family unit looks like. They're going to go right back into the, you know, the frying pan, so to speak. Do you work with the families at the same time that the patient is in treatment?
Both. Someone comes to me, it could be the family member that's saying we're having problems at home, or it could be the addicted person. Either way, I'm going to say, let's get other people in here because I want the whole story. That's the, you know, if you're the addict, even if you really want to get into treatment, and of course, you know this, it depends on why you came to treatment. To just say, you know, I've looked at myself, I'm addicted, I really need to start dealing with this for me. Or did your spouse say, I've had enough if you don't go to treatment? Or did you get a DUI or something like that? And now the court says, you better go or else. So I'm going to look at that part of it. And then I want to get the whole story, so I get the family members in. If it's the addict that comes first, I want spouses and kids and what have you, significant others. And or if it's the family member, I'm saying, well, let's see if we can get the person who's using in. Because the bottom line is everybody needs to be on the same page before they go into treatment. Then everyone's responsibility is explained. Okay, you're a family member who's addicted, we're putting them in treatment. They're willing to go. It could be, you know, depending on insurance, it could be 2 weeks, it could be 2 months, sometimes longer. So, and then while they're there, you and I are going to sit down and we're going to start tearing through some things, not so much about them. You know, I'm going to, first of all, make sure you know everything about addiction so you understand it. And then I want to tear into your own life and see, you know, what you've come from. Was there addiction in the family? Are you dealing with any mental health issues? What stressors are in your life? And then prepare that person, because you know, I'm sure you know this, if you come out of recovery, for a lot of people, when the addict gets home, you know, this is a house where they weren't involved in a whole lot of what went on, and now they have to integrate into a system. And then the family members have to make room for that addict to come back in, because now that person who is, you know, of sounder mind, if you will, wants to get involved in things. And you'd be surprised how turfy family members get. And say, all of a sudden, you want to do things your way. You weren't even here before to do all this. And then the addict said, what am I doing all this for? And now we go back. So we want everybody prepared for what's going to happen.
And for the people that are watching that are at the very early stages of maybe they're contemplating changing, what kind of things would you say to somebody that is contemplating making a change and maybe starting to go to 12-step meetings or maybe see a therapist or go to rehab or doing an IOP? What kind of things would you tell them are the kind of things that they should be? Why should they be doing this? What's the reasons that you want to make a change?
The first thing I tell people is, because they'll say things like, it's not my problem. But what I say is, just go and listen to other people. And when they talk, you know, be able to say, Am I experiencing some of that? Not the conditions, those can be different, but some of those feelings. Get the information from professionals and from other people who are living the recovery program. Understand that. When you get there, it's about your frame of mind when you walk into the meeting. If you walk in and say, I really don't want to do this. Well, now you pretty much have said, I don't know that I'm going to listen to these things. I don't know why I'm here. Go with an open mind. Say, okay, I'm going to a meeting. Let me see what this is all about. Let me just kind of put those fears aside. If I have them, I can certainly bring them up when I'm at the meeting. That's what we do. If you're concerned about it, I'm not sure how this is going to help me, then talk about that. Don't hold it in. Say what you got to say. Let people help you. Be willing to get a little humble here, because you know that arrogant thing we talk about with addicts, it's there. It's one of the reasons why it's often difficult to help them. But you'd be surprised how the arrogance spreads to family, and we have a more subtle form of arrogance. I'm not going to surrender this because I don't trust anything, because I know I live with this person, and now you're going to tell me I'm going to help you. The arrogance doesn't show itself in family members like it shows itself with the addict. That's more in your face. The arrogance is more passive with family members, and I explain that to them. You know, your arrogance is in protect mode. It's survival mode, and no one at that meeting is gonna get in the way of that. No one's gonna harm you by going to the meeting. So be able to just go in there with a clear mind, you know, a willingness to listen and share and be honest with it. Give it a chance for, you know, a month, three or four meetings. Go, even if it's only once a week. The other thing I tell them is don't just show up alone. If you do the first time, sometimes you don't know anyone and you go, the next time, go with someone else. Say that at the meeting. I'm new to this. It's a little scary. I need a contact person. I need someone that's going to guide me through these initial steps. Open up to that so that you have some support when you're going.
And, you know, you hear a lot about trauma as being underlying these things. Once you get to a rehab, I went to rehab. Unfortunately, I went twice. The second time actually was more valuable than the first. I like to say that, you know, I was a young man when I first got sober in my 20s, and I remained sober for almost 30 years. And then after having some surgeries, I decided it might be a good idea, since I was such a different person than everybody else, that I could handle oxycodone and medication that they gave me for these surgeries, and that wasn't the case. I like to say that I watched the movie already now. I know how it ends, and I don't have to watch it again. That's been my own experience. So the relapse doesn't have to be part of recovery. But in my case, it was a really good thing from which I learned and has led to a rededication to being sober in my own life. Underlying trauma, as I've learned, is pretty important to get into, and not just treat the fact that I'm going to put down the substance, but take a look at what's underlying that. You get into that, I'm sure. And why is that so hard to get into? And what kind of techniques do you use to help people get to that stuff?
You know, it's a great question. When I deal with people, I tell them, it's great, you're going to go into recovery. And the first steps of recovery are just get you sober. That's, you know, now the work begins. People think that, well, the work was getting into the program in one way or another and getting sober, and you're great. That just cleared the deck. That's all it did. Now we're going to talk about what I like to call undercurrents. And I always tell them that your life occurred on a timeline. So, you know, and what has occurred is there. It's part of who you are. So, you know, the undercurrent keeps flowing. And, you know, in the day when I, way back when I started doing all this, we would use the term, the program used the term a lot, called dry drunks. And what they were really referring to is getting yourself away from the substance, but the personality and the things that helped get you into the addiction or help sustain it are still there. And that's when, you know, you hear family members say, great, you're not using, but you're still the same SOB you were, or whatever it may be. Things have happened. We've been abused. We had traumas in our lives. Could be anything. A sudden death of someone. family, you know, a divorce, whatever it may be. We want to go back and get those, because what undercurrents do is they help us develop these nice little trigger points, you know, and because they don't always stay under, they kind of poke their head up a little bit. And when they do, that's a trigger. And, you know, either we go right back to the substance, or our personality changes a bit. We struggle. So I always go back with people. I see, you know, I help put them in the rehab, so to speak. Now they come back and I say, now your work begins. And now we're going to go back. And the first thing I get is, no, I'm really doing great. I don't even have the urge to use. I said, that's only the first step. You know, dealing with urges, that's fine. And that's why you should be going to meetings and why you should have a sponsor. You know, that's another thing, you know, when you talked about undercurrents, I work closely with the sponsors. You know, I've been around the program long enough that people will trust me. Sponsors will say, sure, as long as the person's okay. So I know what the sponsor's doing. I know what step they're on. I know how they're working the steps. So because if we can do that and you can coordinate those efforts, then the person is going to start dealing with undercurrents, saying, yeah, remember when my dad did this, or experiencing this thing, or here's the horrible thing I did in addiction.
It's unbelievable. I've never heard of a psychologist working with the sponsor as well as the patient or the sponsee. That's incredible. I've been around for a long.
I was fortunate in that regard. In my earlier days, when I got certified, I was what they call the drug and alcohol counselor in a prison. I took the job. I was working at an alcohol counseling agency, and you know, so getting my feet wet in all these kinds of issues. And this, I was going in there once a week for a couple hours to counsel some inmates. And they said, "Hey, you know, we like what you're doing. We have this position opening. What do you do it?" Well, what happened is then I started AA meetings in the jail, and sponsors were coming in. We did a lot of work together with the people. So they started, it's just them going back to meetings saying, yeah, we finally got someone over there. He's involved. And it spread from that point. Then over the years, you know, in our area, there were probably on any given day, there had to be 10 meetings running, you know, different times of the day. So, you know, and people would go to different meetings. Some of the people, some people go to a meeting once a week. Some people go two times a day. So they would start spreading the word. So I started to realize that's a component that I never heard, you know, counselors are, unless they're in the program, that are dealing with the sponsor. So sponsors are real good about referring people to me, and then we track them through. And then I always know what's going on. I understand the program. I work the program. You know, I'm not, and I, probably something I should have said earlier. People talk about the 12 steps as a program for addiction. It is not. It works there. It's a program for life. If everyone used this program, things would be much different in our lives. I use it every day, you know, from the beginnings, you know, every day, my day is about humility and surrender and gratitude and all. I put those things in every day. So doing that and working with the sponsors, we put together a program that, you know, it's like a tag team on people. You know, I'll say, did you go to a meeting? Yep. Have you been talking? Yep. Nope. Your sponsor says no. You sat in the back of the room. Well, you know what? And then it comes to the excuses. And then we can work. What that does is it touches on the undercurrents. Okay. You're not doing this. Why?
Yeah. I mean, we're brilliant people. Who are addicts and alcoholic at separating the different people, whether, you know, at any stage, we're very manipulative. And the idea of coordinating, helping somebody with all the different people at once, you really can't get away with much.
You can't, you know, and I always tell addicts, I say, if you would put as much effort into your recovery as you do avoiding it, I mean, you can put 50% of the time in and be twice as good as you are right now with your recovery. You know, it's a full-time job. It occupies the mind all the time. And when you want to talk about an undercurrent, this I think is the biggest one. It is the one that I am an addict, and that always stays in my head. We want to keep it fresh, but we don't want you focusing on the manipulations and the, like you said, separate this one out, separate this. They're good at that. They separate the crowd and they, okay, I got your weakness. I can move you here. That's automatic. And that's something an addict has to know, that while you're doing that and you think it's okay, you know, that's a survival thing and we all should do it. It's keeping you, you know, cemented into your addiction. You've got to be able to let that go.
For me, it the hardest thing when I'm trying to help somebody, especially somebody that's just coming out of treatment, is making that initial connection with other people. There's a fear. Maybe it's a fear of not wanting to ask for help. Maybe it's a fear of not wanting to let anybody know what's going on. But the connection with the community is so important. And it's the thing that's the hardest thing when you come out of treatment, to be able to make the transition from that bubble. You know, I ask people when they first come into treatment, maybe if they're in their second or third week. And when I worked with the Care and Treatment Center, I'd ask somebody in their second or third week, I'd say, how do you feel now? Oh, I feel great. I'm at the gym. I'm now walking and I'm running. And when I came in, I said, well, and so when you came in, how did you feel? Oh, I was terrible, whatever. So, well, that's exactly what happens in recovery. You take a look at where you were in day one, take a look at where you are now in day 21. And that's what happens when you get out of here. But getting somebody to go in and do it kind of on their own when they're outside the bubble is a tough thing to do.
You know what I find is that all of us, but addicts even more, when we get to the point that we're uncomfortable, we look for something to quickly change that rather than say, why am I uncomfortable? You know, and I say, when they come into treatment, I say, let's do this. And they say, oh my God, I don't think I can do that. And I say, I didn't ask you to cut your arm off. All I said was try this step. But why are you not doing it? And we're back into the same thing. Quick fix. I that hurts. That makes me really uncomfortable. I don't want to do that. You know, and so I just break it down to steps. You know, I say, okay, fine. Let's just do this. You know, you're afraid to go into, for example, one came in and said, social event, I got to go to this person's wedding. I know what's going to happen. I get into that church. I said, just go in the church and sit in the back. Okay. If you really can't do it, get up, but say, let me just take a 5-minute break and I'll try to go back in. There's always an exit plan, but the exit doesn't have to be a full exit where you go back to the addiction. Sometimes you just need a pause. And during that pause, though, say, what am I feeling here? What am I thinking about this? Why is it difficult for me? And be willing to take that back to your sponsor or counselor. Because that's not something that's moving you backward. That's moving you forward. When you experience that fear and you're willing to talk about it, that's a step forward, not backward. And addicts, anyone coming into counseling, but particularly in addiction, we'll interpret that as a step backward. Crap, I tried this. I can't do this. No, you got to the point where you were before and you used through it. Now you're being confronted with it. There's a difficult piece to this. Ask yourself a few questions. Get to your sponsor. If you can, call them on the spot before you forget or decide to make a different decision. Hey, I just walked out of this thing. I got really scared. You know the person, whether it's myself or it's your sponsor, we're going to ask you, good, let me know what's going on. Tell me what was happening. Tell me how you're feeling. That little piece, and it seems small, is huge in your recovery, because what you did is not run away or not be willing to work it. You didn't go use. You took the next step. You said, I'm uncomfortable. I don't know what to do with this. Help me.
Yeah, building block.
Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah, it builds a progression where you can actually make a move. So when you deal with trauma, do you deal with trauma patients that have trauma? I know you run the gamut between addiction and mental health disorders and things like that. But do you do that in the in one-on-one counseling, or do you have groups that you run? Because you do virtual therapy with people. If people are interested in connecting with you and they want to connect with you to be able to help themselves and connect with you on a virtual basis, you do that as well, right?
I do. I do that because it got fashionable, unfortunately. You know, I always say, if we're going to make changes, they should be client-centered changes. But online counseling is not client-centered. That's practitioner-centered. I think we have to be able to understand that. That happened during the pandemic, and we should have come out of the pandemic and went back to, you know, one-on-one kinds of things. We didn't. So, you know, I'll do that with people. But, you know, I prefer that one-on-one kind of thing. And that's why I use the program so much and getting involved with sponsors, because there's your group setting. Bring it back to that. Sometimes we do IOPs, intensive outpatient programs, and that gives them a group component. But when I get into all these things, it is with the person, one-on-one, and then the family. And I could have two people, I could have five, six, seven people in my office at one time. We'll do it that way if we have to. I find that addicts tend to hide in group settings. And they almost all, unless you're really into the, you know, in early stages, they tend to hide in those group settings. So, you know, I'll hit them head on where they can't run away from me.
And, you know, we'll put links up and we'll make sure people can get in touch with you. But while we're talking about it, how do they get a hold of you if they want to connect with you and have a conversation about getting help?
Yeah, easiest way is my website. It's my name, fostergerald.com, and everything about me and the program and how I run it and the books I've written are all there, but there's a contact link. And I always encourage people, you know, reach out, because I do get back to people. You know, there's a lot of us that say, reach out, and then 3 days later, nothing has happened. So if I see that you've reached out, then I'm going to get back to you as soon as I can, usually in the same day.
People who need some help, who need to connect with somebody who knows how to counsel, knows how to direct, knows how to put you on the right path, will be likely to reach out to you, because if I know anybody, I'm certainly going to give your name out as somebody that they should be talking to. Thanks so much, Foss, for being with us as a guest on Crosstalk Podcast. And I want to tell all our listeners, thanks so much for watching. Thanks for listening. Hit that bell. Follow us, subscribe, and let us know what you like and what you don't like, and we'll answer you. We'll get back to you. Not in 3 days, but we'll answer you right away. And thanks so much for being here, and we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.